Fields. So we've seen some chiral superfields, which are going to contain our matter, and the vector superfields are going to contain our gauge bosons and their copies. So, of course, we have, for a vector superfield V, we have our constraint, which is that it's real. So what we can do is look at our general superfield and just impose that constraint to work out what the components are of this thing. That's a pretty easy exercise. It's kind of obvious. But so we have some real scalar field C, some fermion, left hand fermion chi, and its Hermitian conjugate chi bar. And then these scalar fields come in this combination, M plus IN. Okay, and we have the Hermitian conjugate part as well. Then there's a real vector field V mu, just as in the general superfield. And there are some additional pieces which come in. To do with the fermions, theta bar lambda bar of x plus I over 2 sigma bar mu d mu chi. And then we get the Hermitian conjugates of that term as well. Okay, and then finally, there's the D term. And I'm just going to, for convenience, we're going to write it, instead of just a one scalar field D, we're just going to redefine it and subtract box C from it, just because it'll make life a bit easier later on. But this whole thing is what we called D before. We've just done just taken a little piece off it. Okay, so let's count up what we've got. I told you last time how to work out whether they're fermions, bosons, or vectors. And basically, you know, we can tell by the fact that this is dotted in with a theta bar that it's a fermion. It's got an alpha dot index, so it's a right-handed spinner. So we have counting up real degrees of freedom. We have 8 bosonic components. C, M, D, and N, and each component of V mu. Okay, so that's 8. And there's 8, or 4 plus 4, fermionic ones. Because each of these fermions, chi and lambda, is complex. So we have two components of each, and they're each complex fermions. Okay, so of course we've got a vector field V mu in here, and we're going to use that to provide the photon in QED, for instance. And so we've got to worry about how we enforce gauge invariance. And that follows from the following observation. So let's introduce a chiral superfield now, which I'll just call lambda. So I of lambda minus lambda dagger is real. Therefore, it's an example of a vector superfield So if you just put in a general chiral superfield lambda and in terms of the component fields psi and phi and so on, and you expand, you just write down what this thing is, what you'll see is something that looks like the vector superfield that we wrote on this board, but with some identifications between the components. Sorry, you can't see. Turn that round. Maybe that's better. So if you do that, of course, then this C field that we have here, written in terms of the chiral superfields, is just going to look like I phi minus phi dagger, right? Because that's the first component. The chi in the vector superfield, it just looks like root 2 times psi in chiral. M plus IN looks like the F field, the complex F field from the chiral superfield. V mu looks like minus D mu phi plus phi dagger. And it looks like we have, for I lambda minus lambda dagger, it looks like we have no zero lambda component and zero d component. Okay, so it's a not general vector superfield, this thing. It's a more specific vector superfield. And what we do actually is that we define a gauge transformation, a sort of generalized gauge transformation. In Suzy, where the vector superfield goes to the vector superfield plus I lambda minus lambda dagger. Okay. So remember, normally when we're talking about QED, what we normally have is that V mu goes to d mu minus d mu alpha of x in QED, okay? And what we see here is that and there might be a factor of I wrong. Let's check that. But yep. So here, so with our generalized gauge transformation, V mu goes to V mu minus D mu phi plus phi dagger. And I see there's a problem with an I, so I'll sort that out. It may be that the eye is not there. I'll have to check that. But in any case, we can see that basically we get the same thing. That if we set alpha of x equal to... So alpha is a real field, and phi plus phi dagger is a real field. And so we can get a gauge transformation in this way. And, you know, we can also choose some of these components, psi, f, and phi, to get rid of some of the components in the vector superfield. So we gauge away some components of V. So this is an analogy with gauging away some degrees of freedom of the photon in QED. Okay, so this Zamino gauge. So notice that, you know, we can get rid of some of these terms, but we can't touch the lambda the terms with lambda in or the terms with d in, because this transformation doesn't add anything onto them. Yeah.
So normally the gauge transformation, you have something that remains invariant under the transformation. Is there an actual quantity here that's invariant?
Yes. We'll see that later on when we construct four-dimensional Lagrangians. We'll be able to construct using this vector superfield some terms in Lagrangian that are invariant under this transformation. Yeah. So Vesemino gauge, we choose phi, psi, and f such that we can set c to 0. Well, obviously, we can just fix I phi minus phi dagger to minus c, right? And then it's going to get it to 0. We can get chi equals to 0. We can get m and n equals to 0 as well. Okay, so then we've got quite a simple vector superfield, which is welcome, which is equivalent if the gauge symmetry is... If the gauge symmetry is a symmetry of your Lagrangian, your action. So remember, we can't touch lambda, and so we end up with lambda in there. And now, because we'd set up the D term, the D field, to look like D minus box C, you end up with this D here. Okay, so in this multiplet, we see a gauge boson. We see spin half copies, which are gauge enos. And we see this D field. This is a special kind of field which we'll go into at the end of the lecture, called an auxiliary, and it's going to disappear from the theory by the time we finish. But it's a special kind of field. We'll see how that works. So, there's some things to note about vector superfields written in the Vesemino gauge. Notice if we square it, there's only one term. because all the other terms involve either 3 thetas or 3 theta bars, and they have to be 0. Okay, and then obviously now any higher terms now give it also give us 0. Any higher powers of the Vesemino Witten gauge, the Vesemino gauge superfield. Okay, so what I've done to get this square, you have to rewrite this thing squared in terms of this product, and there's you can use some relations that you've already proved to get that. Okay, so there's a little bit of work to do there. Actually, this Vesemino gauge isn't supersymmetric. So what that means is, if you do under Suzy, if you do a Suzy transformation on a Vesemino gauge vector superfield, it goes. You can check what under the general superfield transformations. That'll go to another vector superfield, but it won't be one in Vesemino gauge. You'll have some additional terms in there, okay? But it's okay because under a combination of a Suzy and a gauge transformation, then we have we can get back to the Vesemino superfield because under Suzy, as we said above, we get to some other non-Vesemino superfield, and then at the same time we do a gauge transformation to get back to some Vesemino gauge superfield. So we impose this combination of Suzy and gauge symmetry at the same time. What of doing this business? Well, you don't have one. You only have the latter step in QED. Right? You only have gauge transformations. So this is a new thing. So yeah, I mean, this is the gauge transformation in QED, and you can use it to get rid of some of the components of VNU. That's all. Well, it's a generalized gauge transformation, yeah. We should really call it something else, yeah. So, yeah, well, everywhere I put gauge here, it's like generalized gauge. So you have to impose this combination of Suzy and gauge transformation invariance. But that's fine, that's good enough for us. That's what we want to do. Okay. Well, remember... okay, so now we want to ask how our other fields are going to transform under Suzy times the gauge transformation. So this will lead us to a form for the field strength superfield. But consider in non-Suzy for a second, let's just go back and remember what happens to a charged scalar field. So it's a complex scalar, phi. So under the a U1, say electromagnetic transformation, if it's got charge 1, it just picks up this phase, and simultaneously, as we said before, v mu goes to v mu x plus or plus or minus d mu alpha. So that is that, you know, that's the same alpha. It has to be the same alpha, otherwise the interactions between the photon and this scalar won't be gauge invariant. Okay, and so we want to know the Suzy analog. So under Suzy, we have V going to V plus I lambda minus lambda dagger, and phi, some chiral superfield, which is charged. So, okay, so strictly speaking, there's a charge here. So, phi goes to e to the minus 2i lambda q times phi. Simultaneously. Okay, so that's the generalization. So we've got something to notice about this. So this is a chiral superfield. Say it's a chiral superfield. Of course, it might be anti-chiral or something. Then this also is a chiral superfield, because lambda is a chiral superfield, and we can expand this exponential out in the polynomial in lambda, and products of chiral superfields, holomorphic products, are chiral superfields. Yeah?
Should there be a charge in the B transformation relation?
Well, we're doing U1 at the moment, and the vector boson is uncharged, so no. We'll see in a sec how the, I mean, how we actually couple these two things such that it's invariant. I mean, I can tell you now. Where are we? Since it's come up, oh, I can't find it in the notes. Okay, I can't find it right now.
In the covariant derivative, the extra term, you have the charge in front of that and that. So let me understand this. The extra term is this Q for the covariant.
Yeah, so what will... yeah, that's right. So we'll see some terms that look like phi dagger e to the 2 Q times V, right? So the charge is coming in there. Times phi, okay, when we write this in a supersymmetric form, and this whole thing is going to be invariant under this change. So yeah, okay, good. And we remember, let's see, that's, so this thing remains chiral if phi is chiral. And before supersymmetry, so you remember the field strength of QED, I'm sure you'll remember, F mu nu just looks like d mu v nu minus d mu v nu. And the Suzy analogy of this, I'm just going to give you, and there's some work to do to show that it's got f mu nu within it. So it's written in terms of the vector superfield, and it's minus 1/4 d bar d bar d alpha times v. Okay. So of course there's an implicit summation here. over the alpha dots. So you'll see in a tutorial that's coming up probably tomorrow that this is chiral. So you have to prove that. It's not difficult. It's chiral. And it's invariant under a generalized gauge transformation. So the easiest way to write it is in terms of these y coordinates that I introduced last time. If you write it out in terms of y's, then this is what you get. So there should be mu's everywhere. So we can see the F mean nu coming in. And we have some Gugino pieces as well. And from this, you can expand out in terms of y, in terms of x mu. In order to get how this field strength chiral superfield looks like in terms of x mu coordinates. And it's a big mess. Well, a bigger mess. All right, so that's fine. So what about, let's write down now some, let's talk about some Lagrangians, because so far we've just set up the superfields, but we want to know how to make Lagrangians out of them. So four-dimensional Lagrangians, CZ Lagrangians. So we want to see interactions between the superfields, or interactions. Between W alpha, V and phi, for instance. So we're talking about n equals 1 global CZ for the moment. Might give you a few bits and pieces about what happens when you make CZ local, but we can't go into any detail. So remember, for any general superfield, we have this D term. It's called a D term. So we have lots of terms, and we have something which has two thetas in it and two theta bars. Okay. And when we looked at the CZ transformation of this field, delta D, it was a total derivative. So total derivatives, because we integrate over all of space in the action, they have no local physics in them. Okay, so when we integrate this over all of space, delta D is going to go to zero, basically, locally. And it's the same deal for delta F. So if we consider chiral superfields phi, which have a load of terms plus something proportional to theta theta, and delta F is a total derivative, So delta F and delta D, being total derivatives, have no local physics. In the action. So we can use that to write Cz Lagrangians. Therefore, Cz Lagrangian. We can write some terms which is a function in general of our fields. So maybe we have several chiral superfields. And if we just take the terms proportional to theta, theta, theta bar, then we know when we do a Cz transformation, those terms will just turn into a local derivative and give zero. And so it's going to be Cz invariant. And it's the same for the F terms. We can have some holomorphic function of the phi i's. And if we just take the F terms, then it will also be supersymmetric. So D terms mean coefficient of theta, theta, theta bar, and the F term means coefficient of theta, theta. Okay, K is called the Kähler potential. And is a real function. And it has to be real because only the real functions contain the D terms. Whereas W is called the superpotential. And it has to be a chiral superfield if it's going to have this nice property that we can just extract out the F term. And so it has to be holomorphic. Yeah.
So K is a vector
subfield? No, K's at the moment. It is. Yeah, you're right, actually, because it's a real function of chiral anti-chiral superfields. Yeah. It will be. But we won't be using that fact. But yeah, it is an example of a vector superfield.
We could expand K and the D term, we take the D coefficient of the K vector field.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could look at it like that, yeah. That's essentially what this is saying. Real function, i.e. Vector superfield. Okay, so now let's talk about renormalizable quantum field theories. So taking renormalizable quantum field theories. In 4D, all products of fields for renormalizable theories should have mass dimension less than or equal to 4. Have you seen this before? Yeah.
I'm just curious again, this Lagrangian you've written down, what exactly do you mean by the evaluated at D or the coefficient?
Sorry, evaluated at?
Like, it looks like you said evaluated at D or the coefficient. What is, like, can you give an example of what you mean by that Lagrangian?
We're going to see it actually. But All it means is he takes some function of phi and phi dagger, right, which has to be real. And you're going to get loads of terms with thetas, theta bars, blah, 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 blah. One of those terms with a load of products of fields times theta, theta, theta bar, you just take that term. And you extract off the theta, 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 theta bar. So you just take the coefficient. That's what this means. Just take the coefficient of that in terms of the fields and write it down in the four-dimensional Lagrangian. Yeah. Okay, so, all right. So the way to work out the dimensions of the component fields is to look at the kinetic term, right? And then if you do that for the scalars, you'll see that the fact that the Lagrangian has mass dimension 4, because the action's dimensionless, means that a scalar field has mass dimension 1. So now we consider our chiral superfield. So just remind you, that's what it looks like in y coordinates. So this thing has mass dimension 1. Therefore, the superfield must also have mass dimension 1. And a fermion has mass dimension 3/2 from the kinetic term. Therefore, we can work out what the mass dimension of the thetas is, and it has to be -1/2. Because the mass dimension of this plus the mass dimension of that has to equal 1. And equivalently, the mass dimension of this auxiliary field F is 2. So that means it's measured in Jev squared, right? That's what it means. Okay. All right. So we should have, in the Lagrangian, we should have the dimensionality of all the fields less than or equal to 4 in each term. That will mean that we'll have either 0 or positive dimension couplings, which is a necessary condition for renormalizable quantum field theory. That means, you know, our D terms of the Kähler potential better have mass dimension less than or equal to 4 as a whole. But we've got, you know, this is multiplied by 4 lots of thetas. Okay, you can do the same exercise for anti-chiral superfields, and you'll get the same mass dimensions for theta bar. So we want the D terms of the Kähler potential to be less than or equal to 4. That means that the mass dimension of the Kähler potential is less than or equal to 2 of the terms in the Kähler potential. And so if we're writing it in terms of chiral superfields, in a renormalizable field theory, there's only one possibility. For a real function of a single phi, say. And that's it. Okay, because anything else would have either wouldn't be real. It would have no D term, or have mass dimension greater than or equal to 2 and be non-renormalizable. So you can ask, what about some function which looks like that, or that? Well, these things have no D term. So they're not part of the Kähler potential. Okay, if you go through the same arguments with the superpotential, basically we know the Lagrangian term has to be less than or equal to 4, mass dimension, so the superpotential itself written in terms of the superfields must have mass dimension less than or equal to 3 for renormalizable theories. Okay, so of course, as I stressed before, we don't always consider renormalizable theories. And so there's this example that I could write down in terms of one chiral superfield. So just to bear this in mind as an example. So I can write some couplings alpha lambda times superfield plus m times phi squared. So alpha, lambda, m, and g are coupling constants. Okay, and this is known as the Vesemino-Witten model. That's a renormalizable supersymmetric quantum field theory with one chiral superfield in it. Yeah.
Is Wittgenstein in there? Because the Wittgenstein-Witten model, as I can recall, is a two-dimensional quantum field theory which describes the propagation of a string on a group manifold. So I'm not sure if, as well, that is the Wittgenstein-Witten model.
I can check. Maybe that I accidentally added Witten's name. I'm not sure. Or maybe they've got two models.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I don't know.
Witten was too young, probably.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Anyway,
maybe you're right. So, if we just write down our Lagrangian, to remind you, is now the Kähler potential is phi dagger phi, and we extract the d terms from that, and we take the f terms from the superpotential and add the Hermitian conjugate. All right, so remember remember what this chiral superfield looks like in X space. We derived it, or actually I didn't derive it, but I gave you it last time and asked you to derive it. Okay, so we just substitute that in to this phi dagger phi and extract out the terms proportional to theta 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 bar theta bar. So you can see, for instance, that this times the dagger of itself is going to give one of the d terms, and so one of the terms of the Lagrangian is going to be f times f star. So, okay. So this term, this d term, gives us d mu phi star d mu phi minus I sigma bar mu d mu psi plus f f star. Okay. So that's the first lot of terms. And the second lot is come from the superpotential. And what we do is we Taylor expand. Around the superfield equals to this, its scalar component. And I'm going to write some dw by dphi here, which is defined as dw by d superfield, evaluated at the scalar field. At the superfield equals the scalar field. It's just a bit of notation. Okay, and then what we do is we write our superpotential. We just expand it, Taylor expand it, around big phi equals little phi. And there's only three terms. And you'll see why in a second. So this thing contains several terms, but one of them is theta theta times f. Okay. And this thing contains product of two sides, okay? And we know at the end of the day, from this thing, we're going to extract out all the bits proportional to theta theta. Okay, so we don't need to consider any other terms, yeah.
I'm just curious, with the phi phi term, or the d term, why you don't have phi box phi as well? Or phi star box phi?
Because that's non-renormalizable, because box has mass dimensions of 2, right? Well, if we want renormalizable theory, yeah. Okay, so these are the only terms we need to consider, and we're going to extract, this is going to give us, there's some term which is f times d. W by dphi. Okay, this thing we have to rewrite in terms of theta theta.
So, yep. The smaller phi, is that a superfield or is that a particular value of the sphere? Yeah.
It's the scalar component, right? Okay. We're expanding around the scalar component. So we write this thing as minus, so you can do a bit of work on the spinner components of this, and this will be minus a half theta theta times psi psi by the time you're finished with your epsilons, messing about with epsilons and stuff. And so okay, so now we know. We've got to extract out the terms proportional to theta theta. And so this part of the Lagrangian is going to look like dw by d phi times f. And we have a plus Hermitian conjugate. And then we have this minus dtw
by d phi squared
times psi times psi. Okay. I've written that a bit cack-handedly, but anyway. So we know, so our Lagrangian is just the sum of these two pieces, that one plus that one. So we have this field F, which appears in the Lagrangian, and it's curious because it has no kinetic terms. So let me just write down the part of the Lagrangian depending on F. So we have FF star plus dw by d phi times f plus dw by d phi star f star. Okay, this is quadratic, well, in f. And there are no kinetic terms for F. Okay, so there's no propagator. That's what has this special name as an auxiliary field. It can be eliminated by using its equations of motion. So, in other words, it's not a real field. It doesn't propagate. It's not a dynamical field. It actually just provides a constraint on our theory. So we use the field equations, and in this case, because it's got no kinetic term, the action, which I've written as big S by dF equals zero, or in fact, even the Lagrangian, implies that. So we can consider F star and F to be, because it's a complex scalar field, we can consider them to be independent degrees of freedom. And so we just apply the two field equations. And substitute back in for F into the Lagrangian. And we get our Lagrangian from the F fields. In total, it's just one term, and it's the mod squared of dw d phi. Okay. So this is actually going to give us our scalar potential. Okay, so comments about this. So what we see is that, as expected, n equals 1 cz is a special case of n equals 0, in fact no cz, The Lagrangian couples, scalar and fermion. So I haven't worried about gauge interactions yet. We'll see that in a minute. And it has positive, definite, semi-definite potential because this thing is the mod squared of something. Okay. And also, damn it, I rubbed the Lagrangian off. That was a mistake. Because we can see that the mass, the Majorana mass that we got for the fermion was equal to the mass of the scalar phi. Okay, there's a factor of, we can say this for this model that I wrote down. The quartic scalar coupling for the Vesemina-Witter model, which is the most general renormalizable model of one chiral field, is related to the Yukawa coupling. Okay, so the quartic scalar coupling comes from a term in the Lagrangian, minus g squared phi to the 4 over 4 plus minus g over 2 phi psi psi. Okay, if you just calculate, that's quartic. Right, that's the quartic scalar. This is the Yukawa. Okay, this leads to some cancellations. Of divergences. In, for example, so if you consider the self-energy of a scalar field, so okay, this isn't quite the Higgs, but it's like this Higgs mass correction, then there's a relation between the mass of the fermion and the scalar and the coupling, quartic coupling, and this Yukawa coupling. You get a relative minus sign from the fermion loop, and there's a cancellation which gets rid of this quadratic divergence. And that's because of the supersymmetry is telling you that these two couplings have to be the same. Okay, I think that's enough for today. Tomorrow we'll see some gauge interactions.